It's a pleasure
Then
to
we can
broker
start.
to have everybody. Welcome everybody to Rabbi Leibtags. We're kicking off the series from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. That was a Rabbi Leibtags special, came up with the title, and this is going to be an ongoing series. So we'll pick up, you know, from one week to the next, but we're going on for a number of weeks, and we'll cover the books in Tanakh by Cheney and all kinds of interesting things, I'm sure. And it's a pleasure to welcome everybody, and a pleasure to have Rabbi Leibtags back, and always enjoyable to learn with you. Really one of the top teachers of Tanakh around the world, always teaching everywhere, everyone. And Bakasha, Rabbi Leibtag, it's all yours.
Okay, I guess I thank Rabbi Kelman for giving me this opportunity. And this is the first time I'm doing sort of something open-ended. I was sort of jealous of Mark Shapiro that he has a class and he can go in any angle he wants. So I wanted to pick a topic where I can just teach and sort of have fun. But let me explain why I picked the topic. Actually, it's very timely because of the news today. Today and this whole, like, especially today, I'll just share with you something really I thought very interesting, very sharp, that I heard from a Rosh Yeshiva, from an important rabbi. I won't mention his name because it might be embarrassing, but I think you'll appreciate it. He said today, because of the news with, you know, people, you know, rabbis saying it's more important to open up schools, and you know, I don't have to go into all the details of the arguments going on in the religious community. He says, we have to add special tefillah and refa'enu, when we daven, you know, for everyone's refuah shleima, but we have to have extra kavana and extra prayer in atachonein ladam dat. You know, in the bracha that we ask God to help us, give us wisdom. So he says, we're missing more wisdom nowadays and understanding than we are, certain things only God can control, things that are in our control. But before we start asking for God to help us with our refuah, first bless us with common sense that we can use our heads properly and understand. Now, I want to use that as an introduction, because whenever you're torn between values, one thing that this corona whole pandemic, this whole situation has caused rabbis is, how do you prioritize Jewish values? You know, and not just risk management, but if I can only daven on Rosh Hashanah for 2 hours, what's critical and what's not? No, Rabbi Putin, as most of you realize this year. But if you don't know how the Machzor came about, if you don't understand the basics of tefillah, then you can't make those rough decisions. Now, if I take that analogy, the only way to make those decisions is by studying the sources carefully. And that's what rabbis do for a living. When a rabbi has to give a psak halacha, he has to take all the sources involved, weigh what's important, what's less important. He might have an argument with other rabbis, but the goal is to search for what's the right thing to do. Now, the bottom line decision that a rabbi makes, what do we call that in English? I mean, I'm sorry, in Hebrew, that's called psak halacha. But there's something really interesting, and this will be my introduction. And it's also a shir on Parshat Shavua on the side. How would you translate halacha into English? If someone asked you, you know, if you're having a conversation, the rabbi says the halacha is this. So you're translating that in English. What's the word for halacha in English?
Path.
What would you say?
The path.
Law.
Yeah, Jewish law.
Law, rule, path.
Yeah, halacha or the path. But there's no language anywhere that calls the word for law walking. Because halacha is from walking. The fact that in rabbinic literature, the name for Jewish law is called halacha. In Chumash, it's mishpat, there's Torah, there's a chukim. There's lots of different, remember Avram Shomer, Mishmartim, Mishmotai, Chukotai, V'torotai. There's lots of words in Hebrew for commandments, for laws, for statutes. But in rabbinic literature, the word, what we keep halacha. Now, why, where's that word coming from? Rhythm means to walk. And I think it's super deep why. It has to do with Parshat Shavua. Because in Sefer Bereshit, what happens quite often is there's a theme that's developing. And you might remember in Gan Eden, God was mitalech in the Gan. He was walking, his voice was walking in the Gan. And if you want to keep your distance, you better hide. You know, ask your ancestor. But, you know, God is sort of walking in some, whatever that means. But the first time we have a person walking, it was Chanoch. Remember, Chanoch was mitalech with God. Did that cost him his life or gave him all? It's unclear. But in the generations from Adam down to Noah, the only one who didn't state that he died was Chanoch, and Chanoch was mitalech, was walking with God. And of course, Noach, we'll read this week, Etalim italech Noach. Noach walked with God. So walking with God seems to be something very good. In contrast, when Avram Avinu is chosen and God enters a covenant in chapter 17, what does God tell Avram Avinu? Chumash doesn't describe Avram like it described Noach. Noach was described as, in a passive way, what he was. He was Tamim. He walked with God. When Avram enters a covenant with God, it's towards the future. It's Hitalech Lefanai V'yetamim. I'm sure you remember that pasuk in chapter 17 in Bereshit. I don't want to bore you now with sources. This is just an introduction. But Hitalech Lefanai V'yetamim, that's not why Avram was chosen. That's not why he was chosen. That's not the reason why God picked him. Rather, that's why he was chosen. Hope you understand the difference. Chumash is not explaining why did God pick Avram over anyone else. That was Noah. You know, God decided to recreate. For the purpose of recreation, he needs a CEO. So why did he pick Noah over anyone else? He was the most righteous person in his generation for what he was. On the other hand, Avram is chosen for what he needs to be. That's why I call why he was chosen, not why he was chosen, if you understand the difference. And therefore, Avram is chosen to start a nation. That nation has to walk with God. Therefore, Litalech Lefnei V'yatamim is key, because that's the underlying reason. We as a nation, Avram has to start a people that's going to walk with God. But how do you walk with God? I need a guidebook. Now, how do you walk with God? The Torah, the Tanakh, is how to lead your life. Halakha is basically how to live your life. And Tanakh is going to be how to lead your life. What have the rabbis done, the way I understand it, over the generations? They study Torah. They study, the Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebapeh. They derive principles and basic understanding of what God wants from us and why we're chosen. And then every generation, the rabbis who are the most learned and our leaders, they make real-time decisions based on their understanding of those principles. And bottom line, what do I do? What we're asking is, how do you walk with God in any time period, in any situation in Jewish history? That's Psak Halacha. And the fact that the rabbis call what we actually do as a Jew walking, I think it goes back to this theme of walking with God, going back to the reason why we're chosen. So the question is, how do you walk with God? To know how to do that, you can't be a robot. You have to have someone with understanding. Therefore, our first blessing, again, in Shemoneh Esrei, we mentioned before, is, in fact, it's story in Gan Eden. God blesses us with the ability to know between good and bad. There's a tree of wisdom to differentiate between good and bad. Therefore, how do you take that knowledge and use it properly? You have to pray for that you use. Most of our struggles are not between good and bad. It's between good and good. I want to do the right thing, but what's the right thing? And that's why God gives us wisdom to know. Now, if I wanted to decide in Judaism what's the right thing to do, so I try to my best to understand what would God want me to do in any situation. Some people say we can't decide on our own. Ask your local rabbi. Again, I think that's the healthiest. But when rabbis are giving different decisions, they have to pick what's called your hashkafa. And that's my introduction. Because how we view the state of Israel today, how we view the establishment of the Jewish state, how we treat it, how we relate to it, what we do with it. One of our decisions nowadays, when an Israeli government gives a law, do we treat the Israeli government like the British, like the Germans, what happens if the Israeli government sends the police in to close a school because it's going against, to close yeshiva because it's going through rules? Is that an evil government or is that our government? You follow? How do you view the state of Israel? How do you view the army? And therefore, that's why the alternate title, which the title was too long to edit, the other alternate title for this whole section is going to be, how do we understand what is Reshit Simchat Gulotenu? It's a big buzzword. This is the beginning of our redemption. So what I want to do in this series is try to get a deeper understanding of what does it mean, the concept of Gula, and what does it mean about our time period? Are we in a time period of Gula? I want to begin with two extremes. What are the two extremes? The two extremes are, I'll take the Zionistic extreme, that we are sure that this is the final Geula. God promises throughout the Bible, he'll redeem his people. And we've been 2,000 years of exile. It's been a long time. But God promised ultimately he'll redeem his people. There's a Masara. There's only two Tochachot, the one in Vayikra, the one in Bechukotai. The first temple exile is B'chukotai. The second temple is Dvarim. Sure, people have learned that before. Ramban alludes to something like that. And therefore, the final redemption will be the ultimate redemption, and we're never going to go into exile again. And hence, if God redeems us, which he just did pretty much, this is the final redemption, and our job is to play with it. In other words, we have to believe this is the final redemption. If we believe that, everything will be great. So, in other words, what does God want us to do? To say, thank you, you've redeemed us, and make it happen. And therefore, we have to settle every bit of the land, and you know, any other decision doesn't make a difference. We're so sure this is final redemption, we have to be the players and make it happen. That's one extreme, because we know for sure this is the final redemption. There can never be another exile. In fact, you'll hear this many times on Yom Yerushalayim, and you know, prominent rabbis will say, you know, we heard from Rav Herzog, we heard from this rabbi, we heard from the, whatever it is, there can't be another redemption. We'll see as we go on, every single major exile and destruction of the Jewish people was when prophets or false prophets or leaders were saying the exact same ideology that there can never be another, the temple can never be destroyed, or God would never do that to us. But there's logic to it, and we'll see, when we study the sources, we'll see that. I'll take the other extreme, whereas basically that God promises us redemption, he's gonna redeem us, and we sit back and wait for redemption. And what is basically redemption? That's God's decision. When the time comes right, if we keep the Torah and mitzvot and we're dedicated to God, God will bring a miracle like the first one coming out of Egypt. The temple will come down with fire from heaven. You almost allude to that on in the Bracha of Nachim on Tisha B'Av. Remember, Ki Atah Be'esh, Atah Hashem Be'esh. You know, you brought it down in fire, and you're going to bring it back in fire. And therefore, we're waiting for this miraculous redemption with miracles, and the temple will come down from heaven in fire. And everyone will live happily ever after in the land of Israel. Till then, we sit and wait and keep Torah and mitzvot and don't ask any questions. You know, that's the other extreme. And who are we to decide for God that this is the final redemption? It will be, but we don't, it's not in our power to make that decision. And therefore, all the Zionist stuff is just, you know, who knows what. So again, I took two extremes. And of course, I want to claim that both extremes I think are totally wrong, or at least the way I understand it. I'll try to bring sources to support it. And what I want to show you in the series is redemption isn't what will be, it's what can be. You understand the difference? God promises redemption. Redemption can be. God can give you an opportunity of redemption. The question is, will you make it happen? So let me get my two, let me just check the chat real fast because I see a couple of chats there. Okay, the chats are fine. It's just about the, okay. So let me share my screen quickly and make sure I covered everything in my outline. Where's my outline? Where's my outline? My outline is, oh, here we go. Sorry about that. Get our sources up here in a minute. But what I wanted to talk about, now there's my sin. We had why we picked the topic, current events. And again, how you view the Israeli government today, you know, and its laws. There's the religious Zionist camp that's following every single law, outdoor minions, trying to be as careful as possible. And where if we're going to find people sort of not accepting that and not accepting government decisions, forget the medical argument, just for how you view the state of Israel and its laws, even if you don't agree with the law, you keep it. So you know, it's how you view the state of Israel and its religious connection, I think has a big effect on how we relate to the state of Israel today. Okay, and then again, we need to understand how to balance our values. And again, halacha is how we're gonna live our life and tanach how to lead our life. And we have back the concept of reshit tzvichat gulatenu. Now, what I want to begin with, I want to take the word geula, and I'll give you an example of what I do with campers sometimes, like in the summer. You ask them to mention the four cups. Everyone knows the four cups of Passover. Now, most people assume of the four cups that the fourth cup will be geula. Understand why? Everyone knows the four cups. Remember, Votzeiti, all those things. Everyone thinks the geula is the last stage of redemption. But that's what people would think so. But when you remember the pasuk, which I hope you remember in Perek Vav in Sefer Shmot, just take a quick look at it. Let's share my screen again, and we'll go to our Tanakh. If you have a Tanakh open, again, if I want you to start, stay awake a little bit, I'd rather you use your Tanakh in your, have one opened up. But we'll see our Sefer, not that one. We're going to use a English Hebrew. We don't need Ezra yet. We'll go back to Sefer Shmot. Open up Sefer Shmot, chapter 6. I'm sure you know the word by heart. We drink to this again at the Seder. Right before the Exodus, God says, I heard the people's crying. I remember my covenant. Lachem, verse 6. Emor l'bnei Yisrael ani Hashem. God tells Moshe, tell the people of Israel before the Exodus, I'm your God. Votzeti etchem, cup number one, I'll take you out of your suffering. Vitzalti etchem, mi'avodotam, I'm going to save you from your slavery, from your hard work. Cup number three, v'ga'alti etchem, bizro netuya. Gula is the third cup. And the fourth cup is, v'lekach etchem dila'am v'ati etchem d'alohim. Which means gula is not the final stage of a process. It's an important step in the process, but it's not the final stage. The goal is not, gula is not a goal. It's a vehicle towards the goal. What's the goal? God's going to take us to be his people, and he's going to be our God. That's called a relationship. You might remember from about 2 weeks ago on Yom Kippur, more than 2 weeks already, we were singing the song over again, Anu Amecha Vata Eloheinu. That's right from this pasuk. Yeah, we're your people, you're our God. We're your sheep, you're our shepherd. You're a king, we're your subjects, you're our master, we're your servants. We said it in like 12 different ways. That idea of relationship and covenant between God and the people, that's the biggest theme in the Torah. What is Geula? Geula, redemption, is not the goal. It enables to get to the goal. Meaning, if we're going to be a nation in the service of God, I can't enter a covenant with God to be his people if I'm a servant or a slave to Pharaoh. So freedom from slavery and redemption from oppression is only step one in the process. And therefore, this process of redeeming from Egypt has a goal. The goal is not to be free. The goal is that freedom enables you to be able to serve God. What Chazal say, Ein lecha ben chorin, ela mi she'osek b'Torah. If you take a quick little adaption of that. What's a free man? A free man who's free to serve God. Now, any Zionist is going to tell you, well, that's not the goal. The goal is the next line. Ve'beit etchem el ha'aretz, I'll bring you to the land. And you would think that the ultimate goal is coming to the land of Israel. We'll deal with that verse later on. It's not by chance that we have four cups at the Seder, not five, not just because the number four is important. When we study the idea of covenant and the covenant with Avraham Avinu, we'll see why cup five is really part of cup four. Maybe we'll have time to get there today. But again, what my key claim number one is, Gula is not the goal. Gula enables us to enter a covenant. And if we want Gula, if we want redemption, if we're in exile and we're praying for God to redeem us, it's not because we want a better life and we want to be free and we want to lead our own destiny. We want to serve God to the best of our ability. And having our own country and having sovereignty and being a people in our own land, that'll enable us to serve God better. That's a very different understanding of Geula than a more secular one, which is what? If I serve God, there was a question, is the land of Israel a reward for good behavior? In other words, if we're good servants of God, God will bless us with a great land where we can have a great time and live a great life. Or is the land of Israel and sovereignty in the land of Israel and freedom, is that a tool and a vehicle through which we serve God? And that's going to be a fundamental difference between the two understandings. And that's why I want to try and explain to you in our series. And we'll see how Chumash will explain it, how the Nevi'im will understand it, and how it will explain the different arguments that are happening in the beginning of the Second Temple period and our own time period. So let me just review that key point, which I think is critical for the whole series, that Geula is a stage in a process. It's not the goal of the process. It's a tool, or it's an important stage, because the goal is going to be to become God's people. That's the biggest theme of the Torah. And the entire Tanakh, we're a nation as a people in the service of God. Towards that goal, God gives us a land and wants us to have sovereignty and be a people. If we're doing a lousy job, he'll threaten to punish us and take that land away. But we always have that goal of becoming his people. And if we want to return to our land and be sovereign and be free, that is not going to be our reward for good behavior, but rather having the land of Israel be a tool through which we can achieve our goal. And if God gives us that tool and we misuse it, God threatens over and over again to take it away from us. Now, to prove that, I'm going to tell you something which I think is surprising. Let me stop this share for a minute. If someone asks you, the word Geula, do we ever find it in Chumash? We'll take a little break here for a minute. If you want, you can use our chat. We can use the chat and see what's going on. Where in the Torah do we have the word geula? So we saw in chapter 6 in Shmot, v'ga'alti etchem, is a verb. But the word geula is a noun. Anyone know where it is? Okay, so Ruth mentions Goel Hadam. We'll see that. Actually, that's going to be several places. But that's not geula. That's in Smichut, Goel Hadam. It'll be about the redemption of what land? We'll talk about land in a minute. Okay, we'll see. Everyone's saying the land, but we'll see in a minute. There's only one place, one central place in all the Torah where we have geula as a concept. Anyone know where? In what parsha is it going to be? So I'll tell you what you can do nowadays. Miguel Root mentions it on the side. That's true. But in Chumash, here, I'm going to share with you a little tool in case you guys are bored one day. Not leave the meeting. I want to share my screen. There we go. I'm going to do a little concordancia for you. Where are we here? This is a great tool. Let me get my, here we go. There's my Tanakh. And there's a site called Al Torah, and they have this concordance, which is just amazing. Beats any written one. If I put in this concordance the word geula, let's take a look. So I have the word geula that's as a verb, but if I take the word geula, see that? Geula, see that word geula? Shem etzem is a noun. And before I just hit, there's what's called tarshim. Isn't that neat? You don't have to know Tanakh anymore. You just have to know how to use buttons. What do we find? 9 times in Sefer Vayikra, we'll see in 3 chapters of Vayikra, that's it. It's at the end of Vayikra. We have the word geula over and over again. And that's it for the entire Chumash. I think that's startling, isn't it? The word geula, which we're so familiar with, the concept, is only in the end of Sefer Vayikra and Parshat Bahar. It's going to come up later in Yirmiyahu, if you know the Haftarah for Parshat Bahar. I'm pretty sure that's Haftarah for Parshat Bahar, isn't it? Not by chance. Now you see why. They know what they're doing, the rabbis. Now, the verb legal will come up with, if you take the verb here, just put the word ga'al. Okay, so you're going to have hamalach ha-goeloti in Breshit, I think. There'll be gula we talked about in Amzu ga'alta in Shirat Hayam, and the gula that we saw in Begalti Etchem. Tons in Vayikra. Again, all in that section. Bamibor will be goel hadam. Devarim will be goel hadam. Right? And Yeshua would be goel hadam because of Arim Miklat. Wow, look at Yeshayahu. What can you see right away? That Isaiah is going to be a big topic in our class, isn't it? Which Isaiah? Which section of Isaiah? Without getting into trouble, how many Isaiahs? We'll see. You can guess right away. It's going to be the second half of Sefer Yeshayahu. But it's going to be like crazy over there. Miguel Ruth, as someone mentioned. I think someone named Ruth mentioned Miguel Ruth, right? I think Ruth Shea mentioned Miguel Ruth. I wonder why she came up with that right away. And how could it not be Megillat Eicha at least once? And of course, in Tehillim, we'll see. But that'll have our work cut out for us. So I want to use Sefer Vayikra. Now I can go back to my concordancia. And actually, I already copied it in a Word file. Let me stop the share for a minute. Where do we find the word geula? Let me just show you real quickly in our Word file. I just copied it. The geula word in Chumash and Navi is basically all through Vayikra Chafei, Vayikra Chafei, Vayikra Chafei, Parshat Bahar. Over and over again, like 8-9 times there. And then in Yirmiyahu, Lamed Bet Haftara, that's it. The verb ga'al, we have again, in Hamalach HaGoel Oti, V'galti etchem, the pasuk we read before, Potseti V'galti, Nechita B'amzu Ga'alti in Shirat Hayam, and then everything in Vayikra Chafei again. And also in Vayikra Chav Zayin, with the very end about Gulat, when you do what's called Erchin. And then we have Gula Adam, which we'll deal with that word, that different type of Gula later on. That's the main sources that we're going to have of the word Goel. Now we're going to get to work. Let me stop the share. And I want to go to Sefer Vayikra without going into the details. What is a Goel in Sefer Vayikra? If someone owes money, okay, it happens in life, right? Make bad investments. Let's say you have crops and someone comes and steals everything, or there's some, your house gets infested with rodents, whatever it is, and you have no food to eat. And I'm not going to have money again to buy food until next year's crops. They say it's the winter. I have nothing to eat. I'm going to lend money. I need money to put food on my table. I don't have food because it's wintertime. I can't grow any crops. I didn't have any money savings. I have no one to count me out. So what do? I own land. Now my land has potential value in the future. So I mortgage my land. Basically, I sell my land to someone else and he'll give me money. So I have food on the table. You understand what happens? When someone becomes poor and he needs help, so he'll have to sell his land. If you played Monopoly, I don't have to explain anymore. You run out of money before you give up on the game. You can mortgage your properties and hope you land on whatever you call. Hope you make money and hit the jackpot somewhere. So what do? So you have to sell your land to get money. And that person gives you money to survive, gives you a stipend basically. But he's going to take your land and grow crops and he's going to get rich. When you don't own land, you're basically impoverished the rest of it. You have no way to make a living. What are we commanded to do? First is relatives, anyone can help. What's Geula? The Goel is someone who buys the unmortgages the property and gives the property back to the owner. Now, Chumash has a safety net. Every 50 years, all the land goes back to its owner. That's why it's in Parshat Bahar, the laws of Shemitah and Yovel. So in the Yovel cycle, no one can ever get too poor. There will never be a chance. Chumash wants to make sure that what happened in feudal Europe won't happen in Israel, where all the landowners own the land, and either you're a lord or you're a peasant. You're I forget the names, a serf, right? You can be a serf or you can be a lord. Either you own land or you don't own land. And you have this caste system. Chumash wants to make sure that it will never happen long-term, but short-term it might happen. And therefore, what are we commanded to do? To help the person put himself back on his feet. And that's called Geula. And he's the Goel. Or in a nutshell, what happens? When you give a person and buy his field back so that he can own his field, that doesn't put food on his table. That gives him the ability to be independent and make a living. Hope that's crystal clear. Geula is when, in day-to-day life, is when you unmortgage a property for somebody, someone who could not make a living because he doesn't own his land and can't farm it and can't make money from it. When you buy him land, he has the ability to make his own living. Or as a member of the Rambam, what's the highest level of tzedakah? Putting someone into business, giving someone a job so he can help himself. That's the best way you can help someone. Sometimes it's not giving him a handout, but giving him a job or giving him an education that he can make a living on his own without getting into modern day tzedakah collecting. So if that concept is clear, then in essence, what is Geula? Geula is the ability to put someone on their feet. In a similar way, what is Geula that God does for us? When he redeems us from Egypt, he's going to give us the ability to become his people. But again, Geula is not the goal. Geula is going to be a step towards the goal. Because if we're chosen to be a nation representing God, not just as individuals, but as a people, as a sovereign nation, then if you don't have a sovereign nation, you can't reach your goal to the highest level. Now, I want to go back to that earlier pasuk I talked about this idea of Avitalech Lefanei V'Yetamim. We saw, let me go back in order. I want to go sort of backwards from the first time in Chumash that I have this idea of redemption from the four cups of redemption. And remember I told you it seems like the land of Israel is cup number 5? I want to explain to you why it's cup number 4. And we'll do a quick little study into Chumash and it'll help us understand something in Sefer Bereshit. I'll try every week, even though we're doing Beit Sheni, Second Temple material, every week I'll try to fit some little point in that relates to the weekly Torah reading as well, without getting off track. So let's take a look again in Sefer Shemot. Let's go back to our, we were here in Sefer Shemot, I think. Back in Ezra. No, here we are, Sefer Shemot, here we go. I hope you see my screen okay. By the way, if I ever have a Jay will tell me if there's a sound problem or things aren't clear, let me know. Okay, so again, what did God tell Bnei Yisrael? What did God say? God said, remember this phrase. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm God. I appeared to the forefathers with the name El Shaddai, but my name Yudke Vavke didn't know, without going to the topics of Reshit and Shemot, but the special name that God has with our forefathers is the name El Shaddai. And the name of God that Chumash uses when we're in from Egypt, we say Yudke Vavke, the Tetragrammaton, the fancy name for it, God's proper name. And now God's going to make himself known through that name through doing miracles. Then we're told, V'gam makimoti et briti itam. With our forefathers, what has God to Moshe Rabbeinu? I established a covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land that they were living in, and actually they were the land that they were strangers in, and they were temporary in. I'm going to be giving it to you as an inheritance, as we'll see. But I made a treaty with them, a covenant with them, to give them the land that they were just living in temporarily. And also, that's going to be, we'll see in a minute, that'll be Brit Milah, which we're going to go to very soon, the circumcision covenant. And also, I heard the cry of Bnei Yisrael, where Israel is, where Egypt is enslaving them, and I remembered my covenant. If you know your Chumash, Pasuk Dalet is referring to Brit Milah, the circumcision covenant. Pasuk Hei is referring to Brit Ben Abtarim, the covenant of the parts. In a nutshell, I'm assuming you remember these from Sefer Bereshit. There are two core covenants that God makes with our forefathers. We call them Brit Avot. One is made B'Shem Elokim, Brit Milah. The other's name is B'Shem Yudkei Vavkei, the Brit Ben Abtarim. Brit Ben Abtarim talks about the God of history putting us down to Egypt, making us a nation, taking us out of Egypt, doing it in a miraculous way. And this, the idea of the historical redemption, and the God of creation, Shem Elokim, the God who brought the flood, or the God who made a covenant with Noah after the flood, called Brit Keshet, the rainbow covenant, and promises never to bring another flood again, or never to start over again. Sort of the God of creation, the God who makes nature, that'll be God's name, Elokim. Of course, we were screaming at the end of Yom Kippur that they're the same God, didn't we? Remember? Hashem Hu Elokim, Yud Kei Vav Kei. It's all the same God. In case you weren't so sure, you had to say it seven times. But that's a key theme in Chumash. But it's one God, but we just use different names of God to reflect different perspectives of our relationship with God. The oversimplifying, the God of history, Yud Kei Vav Kei, the God of nature, Elokim, but they're all the same God. But our relationship with them, and God manifests itself sometimes through historical events, sometimes through nature. Now, therefore, that's the background. Therefore, tell Bnei Yisrael, I am God, and I'm going to take you out of your suffering from Egypt. That was one. Hipitzalte etchem. I said, Gula is cup number three. And then I'm going to take you out and bring you to Mount. That's going to be Brit Ben Abtarim, getting out of Egypt. I'm going to make you my people, and I'll be your God. I'll show you in a minute. That's going to be Brit Milah. We'll prove this in a minute. And then you'll know that I'm the God who took you out of Egypt, and that's why. And then after you enter the Brit, then I'll bring you to the land that I wanted to give your forefathers, and you're going to have it as a morashah that's going to be sovereignty. That's Sefer Yeshua, Lareshit et Haaretz. And what I want to explain to you, why that cup number four, Balakachti, that's the goal, and cup number five will be a vehicle to understand the goal. And this is going to be core, in my opinion, of understanding religious Zionism, but also the core of understanding the argument within religious Zionism about where is the land of Israel in my pyramid of values. When I want to prioritize, like happens unfortunately too often, what's my highest Jewish value? Suddenly land of Israel, or maybe some other Jewish value. At what stage is the land of Israel so important? I want to go back to where this topic began in Perek Yud Zayin and Sefer Bereshit. So let's go back to Sefer Bereshit, Perek Yud Zayin. It's real simple. Chapter 17 begins with a very interesting introduction where Avram, God, Yud Kei Vav Kei, has been talking to Avram many times. But now God introduces himself for the first time with a new name. God says, for the first time, God tells Avram Avinu, my name is El Shaddai. This is the first time God introduces himself as El Shaddai. And remember, Hitalech Lefanevi Atameh, that's what you need to be. Why the introduction? Because I'm about to make a covenant between me and you and with your offspring. Now, if God's going to have a new name, Avram's going to have a new name. And therefore, Avram is going to fall down and Elohim speaks to Avram. The last time Elohim spoke to anybody in Sefer Bereshit was the rainbow covenant in chapter 9 with almost the same wording. And this is, again, Yudkei Vavkei spoke to Avram Avinu over and over again with Lech Lecha and every event up until chapter 17. But now for the first time, Elohim, the God, the name that Chumash uses to describe the God of creation and of nature, he's going to speak to Avraham Avinu about having children. Pru-Urvu always goes with the name of Elohim ever since chapter 1 in creation, as we read on Shabbat. And what is God? What does Elohim tell Avraham Avinu? Ani nibriti tach, I'm going to make a covenant with you. Stop here for a minute. Bait elav hamon goyim will return to in a second. And again, God changes Avram's name to Avraham. God has a new name. Avram have a new name. With the new name, you're going to have children that will enable you to have children that are become going to come that nation. You're going to be a nation with kingdom. Like you'll be a sovereign nation with sovereignty, with kings. And then here's the phrase, Vakimoti et briti beniu benecha. I'm going to establish a covenant between me and you and your children after you. Lebrit olam, that word will be key. Brit olam means an eternal covenant. Just like the rainbow covenant is a brit olam, and there's an oath brit. Remember, there's a reminder of the covenant, the rainbow. But the covenant is God is never going to bring another destruction. It'll be an eternal promise that God will never bring, start over again with civilization. He accepts mankind for what it is, or humankind for what it is. But I'm now going to establish a covenant between you and your offspring, an eternal covenant. I'll be your God, and the corollary is you'll be my people. And therefore, the fourth cup, is built on Brit Milah. Now, before we get to Pasuk Het that talks about the land of Israel, I want to go back to what I skipped in Pasuk Dalet. Put yourself in Avraham Avinu's position. What does God tell Avraham Avinu? Ani hinei briti itach. Behold, Avraham Avinu, I'm going to make a covenant with you. What do I expect the next line to be? Is it going to be, what's the reward of the covenant? Or what's the purpose of the covenant? Hope you understand my question. Avraham, God has this tremendous introduction. My new name is El Shaddai, whatever that means. We're not learning Sefer Bereshit now. That's a unique name with our forefathers. It's only in Sefer Bereshit and only in relation to name changes. The process of God choosing Avraham Avinu and the birth of Yitzchak is the first El Shaddai. The last time God says, my name is El Shaddai, is when he changes Yaakov's name to Yisrael. And only in that relationship of the process of being chosen, who's going to be chosen, is that special name. But in that covenant, what do we find? God says, I'm going to make a covenant with you. What is the purpose of the covenant? I expect to find out what's it all about. Not what's the reward, but what's it about? Well, what's the next line? That sounds like reward, not purpose, does it? It's, I'll make a covenant. What's the covenant? You get to be the father of many nations. Now, is Avraham Avinu the father of many nations? Oh boy, there's Ishmael, isn't there? There's Amalek even. There's Esav, there's Edom, there's Am Yisrael. But there's Midian and Medan. Whoa, sure, there's tons of nations coming from. Is that what Brit Milah is about? I can't accept that. I'm going to follow the Netziv. I think other parshanim as well, that this isn't reward for the brit. This is the purpose of the brit. And the word avir does not mean a biological father, but rather it means the what would be the good word? Like the father of modern medicine, a mentor. You'll be a mentor for other nations to learn from. If you remember in yesterday's parsha, I'll just go right to Sefer Bereshit and Perek Daled, when we got to the children of, here, in the end of chapter 4, right here. Remember Tzila, I can have English Hebrew there. You see the thing from Genesis 4 in Sepharia? You there? Okay. So what happened? Lemech had two wives. Remember Ada and Tzila? Strange. And Ada gave birth to Yaval. And he was Avi Yoshev Ohel Mikneh. What? He's a father. It's like saying he was a father of modern medicine. He was the father of all those who dwell in tents, not the ancestor. I think that's a poor translation. He's the one who came up with the idea of settling down in tents. And he's the first, basically, idea of shepherding, of being a shepherd watching sheep. And he started that movement. Now, then comes Yuval, his brother, who's the father of all musicians. These are all special human traits. These are humans are different than animals. We domesticated animals, like sheep and cattle. And we play musical instruments and write music and things like that. And, oh, they have another brother from Tzila. He was Tuval Kain, and he's the father of metalwork. You know, from the Iron Age from Barzel. From iron to, what's the names? I said there's bronze, iron, Oh, it says here in English. I'm sorry. From copper to iron. Okay. But what's that mean, the father? Got it? What's Aviko Tofes? It means he's the one who started something. Later on, you might remember, when Yosef finally tells his brothers, hey, I'm Joseph, your brother, go tell daddy I'm Av to Paro. I'm Pharaoh's daddy. He's not Pharaoh's daddy. Got it? But rather what? He's his mentor. It's clearly he's his mentor. And therefore, the way I understand Av Hamon Goyim, it's not that this is the reward for the covenant or the purpose. The purpose of the covenant is I want you to become a nation that will be a mentor for other nations, or the big topic of being a light to other nations. And anyone who studies Yeshayahu or all the prophets of redemption and the goal of redemption, the whole thing of being a light to other nations, something that religious Zionism, these parts of religious Zionism, make a big deal about it. That concept begins right here in Brit Milah. There's a purpose of this brit. I want a nation to be a mentor for other nations to learn from. Now, to be a mentor, you have to be a ball player. And therefore, I can't, if you're going to be a nation, you need people. And remember, it's going to be a brit, and then it'll be a brit olam, isn't it? We'll just say here, brit olam, it'll be an eternal thing. To be eternal, well, humans, they come and go. They die ultimately. A nation can remain eternal. In my opinion, that's why pur vu is a commandment only for Am Yisrael. It's a blessing for all nations. The commandment of pur vu, we're commanded to have children to the best of our ability. Why? In order to fulfill this covenant. It was in order to fulfill the covenant to be God's people forever, we have to have children and we have to educate those children. And to remember that, we're going to have an oath brit. And guess where we're going to put it? You can do the math on your own. The reminder of that covenant will have something to do with having children. We'll do circumcision. The covenant is for everybody, but the reminder, it relates to the need to have children, and therefore, v'freit yotcha pruvu is in this covenant as well. Beforehand, but now barbel tcha b'mod mod, all the things of creation are coming here. Now, why do I do all that? Because the key covenant is pasuk zayin. I'm going to be your God, you'll be my people. You're going to be a mentor for other nations. First, you have to have a nation, you need people. And you have to keep that nation going. You have to have an ethos. You have to pass that down and teach that from generation to generation. But to be God's model nation, you need to be a nation. To be a nation, you need a land. And therefore, what does God say as an appendix to this? Pasachet, v'natati lecha ulezarcha acharechet eretz b'guracha. In order for this covenant to come into fruition, what do I need? I'm going to give you a land. You and your own have a land. The land that you've been wandering in your land, at Eretz Kanan, Lachuzat Olam, it'll be your eternal inheritance set aside for you, and there I'll be your God. The Ramban takes this to an extreme. It says, only the land of Israel, this happens, and all the mitzvot and chutzlars are only the Rabbanan. You might remember that. We're not going to go into that now. I don't think the Ramban meant that halachically, he just meant that thematically. But what he's saying is that what I want to explain here, it's not that if you fulfill the covenant, your reward is the land of Israel. But in order to fulfill this covenant, for me to be your God and you to be my people, I'm giving you a vehicle, the land of Israel, in order to fulfill that. You understand why I'm spending so much time on this? Because this is fundamental to understanding religious Zionism, where the land of Israel is not reward for good behavior. It's a tool through which we can achieve our goal. It's a tool. If we misuse it, God might take it away from us temporarily, but it's eternally set aside to be the place where this relationship will reach its ultimate. Now, we can fulfill this goal partially in the exile, or as we'd like to call it, the diaspora. It's a more, it's an easier word to use. In other words, we can always be God's people no matter where we are, because the Torah keeps us together and our goal of returning one day becomes. But don't give up on that hope. That's the Rambam's final principle, that no matter how long this takes, even if we're in exile for thousands of years, sooner or later, God will bring us back to our land. But what happens when we come back and we leave again? That'll be a later topic. But the land of Israel, the way I want to understand it here in this covenant, which is a key covenant between God and his people, and the whole phrase of Liot Lachel Elohim, which was so central to our prayers on Yom Kippur, that he's our God and we're his people. In order, what I want to say is, Pasachet is in order to fulfill that as a vehicle, not as the goal of the covenant, but as a vehicle of the covenant, I'm giving you a land to be your God. Now, I agree that it's easy to understand the pasuk very differently. And I have a lot of religious Zionist friends who argue and say, no, The whole reason why God is making this covenant is so that we'll live in the land of Israel. And God's goal is he wants Jewish people living the land of Israel. And for some mystical reason, God just needs Jewish people, descendants of Abraham, living in this land and settling every inch of it. And that's the most important goal in Judaism. I want to use the rest of Chumash to explain the way I was suggesting, that the main goal is a nation, a mentor for other, a nation representing God. To be God's model nation, you have to be a nation. You have to have borders. You have to have secure borders. You have to have an economy. You have to have a government. You have to have an army. You have to be a nation like other nations. And once you're a player on the field, once you're a nation, like once you're one of the 70 nations, then you can be a nation and nations can learn from other nations. And you can't miss that theme later in the Torah. That's why I want to try and show you that idea and how that's going to play itself out in the beginning of Ayin Sheni. So let me stop for a minute in case there's any questions. I'll take a quick break. And I want to go back to, I want to now introduce the title from Lord Balfour to, but let me take, I'll take a quick stop. I'll stop for questions if there are any. I'm an innovator. That's a good point. And okay, and restore. Okay, very good. Now, let's go back now to the title. From King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. I hope you understand why the title. The question is going to be, and we'll have to do this probably more in detail at the next year. Where in Chumash does God promise coming back to our land? So in our generation, over the last 100, 100, 200 years, we've come back to our land after many years of exile. If I'm looking for a precedent, listen carefully. If I'm looking for an historical precedent where there are basically almost no Jews living in the land of Israel and no political entity, there might be individual Jews, but I'm talking about a political entity, not necessarily sovereign, but some political entity of Jews in the land of Israel, even a community, but a group of people living in the land of Israel as a people, or at least as a community. Where do I have a situation where that did not exist at all? No one was here. And the Jewish people in mass, relatively, come and establish a Jewish entity in the land of Israel. How many precedents for that are there in Jewish history? Where the Jewish people are not in their land, in the land of Israel, and no one is here, and relatively in mass, a large group of Jews come and establish a Jewish presence, a Jewish political presence in the land. There aren't too many precedents, are there? How many are there? Well, the first precedent is the Exodus, isn't it? And say for Yeshua, coming out of Egypt, we become a nation in Egypt.
Mm, that's true too.
Now again, Avram Avinu doesn't count because Avram Avinu is not a nation in the land of Israel. He's on a pilot trip, isn't he, Avram Avinu? He comes from Mesopotamia half his life. He goes to Egypt, comes back. Yitzchak hangs out here a lot, but not much of a family. And his family's, you know, barely survives. He has only one kid is chosen. Yaakov isn't here very long, is he? No, he's here without a family, you know, fighting with his brother. He grows up basically by Lavan, becomes wealthy there. He's in Israel for about 20 years and goes down to Egypt again. So as a people, we become a people in Egypt. And there's no Jews living in Israel. And with the Exodus, it's when we first set up and fulfill that goal. And that's exactly what we read in Parsha Vayera. The goal of the Exodus is to enter this covenant with God and then get the land of Israel to set up the nation. Why does it take 40 years? If you read Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar, it takes 40 years because we weren't ready yet. The desert is not just to get to the other side. The desert is to prepare us for the challenge of becoming God's nation. Until we graduate Sinai University, God can't bring us into the land. Even once we go in, we have a lot of failures. But once we're in the land, we try our best. And the job of the Nevi'im is to make sure we stay in the right direction. But the very first time that we, as an entity, as a group of people, we establish a Jewish entity in the land of Israel is the time of Yeshua, the end of Chumash, the beginning of Sefer Yeshua. We're here for about some thousand years about, ups and downs, the time of the judges, the time of the first temple period, the Davidic kingdom, lots of ups and downs. But during that entire time, there's a Mishkan, there's a Mikdash, and the center of the Jewish people is the land of Israel. If you were exiled, you're gone pretty much. The Jewish people are living in Israel. That's the center. There's no like diaspora community, you know, coming here and visiting and things like that. That's all finished in the time of the end of Bayit Rishon with Tzidkiel and the Korban and Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. I'm going to put a little asterisk there because I could do something later about Ashur, but if I have time, we'll go into that. There might have been an earlier wave of exile, which was more important, but not our topic now, but Begadol, we leave Israel with the Babylonian exile. We're familiar with. There was a little hope that there would remain a community, also in Yirmiyahu. God tells, buy land, you'll think can stay. And there was hope at Gedaliah, but good old Sinat Achim. Remember, we fasted for that after Rosh Hashanah, not just because we ate too much, but we had to remember the theme of Sinat Chinam. And remember, it's always good reasons for Sinat Chinam. There's, if you remember, it said for Yirmiyahu, after that incident, Yirmiyahu says, stay. No, the leaders of the people who stood up for Gedaliah, they go down to Egypt. Everyone else, there's no one left, basically. Maybe one or two people, but there's no Jewish community, no Jewish presence in the land of Israel for some 50 years or so. Then the Babylonians are defeated, and they're defeated by the Persians. And the Persians give us the right to come back and set up an entity in the land of Israel. And that's the next time that a group of Jews, maybe not that many, but a large group of Jews, come from exile en masse as a group and establish a Jewish entity in the land of Israel in the beginning of the Second Temple period. And the Jews from, again, with its ups and downs, the Second Temple period, that's around till the temple is destroyed. Even after the temple is destroyed, there's still Jews in the land of Israel in the time of, time of Bar Kokhba revolt. So then we leave Yehuda. We're in the Galilee, in the Golan. Finally, we're gone. By the time, Muhammad comes, we're pretty much out of here. The Byzantines, get things started in the early Islam. And by the time the Crusaders there's no major Jewish presence. There might be a couple individuals, like in the time of Ramban, who come and visit. But there's no established Jewish community. The Jewish people are not in their land. They're in exile. First in Babylonia. That ever since the end of the Second Temple period, right, the first time we return en masse and establish a Jewish entity in the land of Israel is going to be the modern Zionist time period. Now, what's the difference between... So again, I have two precedents. The beginning, Chumash, basically, Sefer Yeshua, and Ezra and Shivat Zion, got it? In our time period. Now, in our time period, we don't have prophets anymore. We have their books, and maybe we can learn from their books, but we don't have a prophet telling us what to do. We have people maybe think they're prophets, but there's, but what do we do in a time period where we return to our land? What's our guidebook? So what model do we follow? Are we following the model of Sefer Yeshua? Conquer, take over, etc. Or we follow the model of Shivat Zion? Because in Shivat Zion, as we're going to see, we don't return en masse, everyone at once, like Yitzhak Mitzrayim. We're not commanded to conquer the land militarily. God doesn't promise to help us wipe out the seven nations. Right? God, through the agency of a foreign power, right, enables the Jews who want to return and set up a political entity without sovereignty in the land of Israel when other people are living there. Many nationalities are living here. And there's no doubt that our time period, if you go back 150 years or so, when the Jews return and establish a Jewish community or Jewish entity, a political entity in the land of Israel, for sure under the Turks, but primarily under the British after World War I, is most similar to the beginning of the Second Temple period than this time of Yeshua. We return under foreign rule. We return only with the help of foreign powers. And that's my title. From King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. Because what enabled us to return in the time of the Second Temple period? That was King Cyrus. Who enabled us to return? Again, there's a lot more than that, but symbolically, Lord Balfour. In other words, when the Zionist movement began, not as a group of Jews coming together en masse and conquering and being commanded to conquer militarily the land of Israel. That was the end of the secular Zionist movement. There was a goal to establish a Jewish presence in the land, a Jewish community, maybe an ideal Jewish community. There were secular hopes. There were religious hopes. But we didn't come in order to conquer the land, take out the inhabitants, and set up a new empire. It ended up happening that way. That was God's issue. But we didn't come to do that. It just so happened, it turned out that God set up a situation where enabled us to have sovereignty. But that might have been original hope, but it wasn't the original plan of the early Zionists. And the question is, how do we relate to that reality? I want to use the sources and the deliberations and the arguments and the challenges of the beginning of the Second Temple period and how the Jews related to the Cyrus Declaration and all the events happening in the beginning of Beit Sheni as a model that we can at least get inspiration from, guidance from, understanding from. And the goal is, let me clarify, because my time is up. I want to clarify not only to say who is right and who's wrong nowadays. The main goal is to appreciate why there's so many opinions and how we can appreciate all the opinions. Because part of our unity is, it's not that, oh, this is gula, that this approaches. I might prefer a certain approach. I'll try to even suggest one. That doesn't mean that my interpretation is correct, and I totally understand other approaches. Like the way we read the Psukim in Brit Milah, how central the land of Israel is. Believe me, I'm a Zionist. I live in the West Bank. I vote right wing. Don't have any doubts. But that's my political views. That's not your issue. I don't have to teach that. As a teacher of Tanakh, I want to try to use the sources of the time period. I want to take the sources of the Second Temple period, which would be the Book of Ezra and Nehemiah, the Nevuot of Haggai and Zechariah. We'll see the story of Megillat Esther, the Book of Daniel. There's lots of sources, and it's so complicated because there's no one book that puts it all together organized. And you got to be jumping from book to book, and you have to make your timelines and outlines and what's going on and why the books are written. It's so confusing, but on the other hand, it's so important because there's no time period in Tanakh that's it's the most similar time period to our time period. And to appreciate the challenges we have, to appreciate the arguments we have, and to help us try to make the best decision how to deal with what do we prioritize? What do we do when we're sourced? Like, how important is settlement in the land of Israel, or how much important is the state of Israel? And what's going to be the more important value? How do you prioritize? How do you value? Again, you can have a political argument, that's one thing. What would a prophet say today? What would the prophets of yore say in our situation today? And we'll see, they're going to argue as well. And therefore, to appreciate and understand the different opinions, and hopefully to bring some unity between them, we're going to study the sources. That was my introduction today of our title, from King Cyrus to Lurik, just because I have him on my share. I just want to show you something really cute. You can go to Wikipedia and see it for yourself. But when we talk about the Cyrus cylinder, first of all, here's from the British Museum. Here's a nice little picture of it. You see it? They found the real thing. Where it is, you can look online, British Museum website. I personally saw it myself. That was one of my highlights of going to London. But there's a translation. It was written in cuneiform. But in the middle of it, there's a nice little translation you'll find on Wikipedia. And what does he say there? He fought, Cyrus took over the Babylon Empire and everyone bowed down to him. And really, what did he say? Throughout the road, from upper sea to lower sea, everyone came to thank, good old, Cyrus. They brought their tribute. They kissed his feet, all these places. As far as in the sacred centers, the other side of the Tigris. What's he say? I returned the images of the gods that had resided there to their places. I let them dwell in their eternal abodes. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned them to their dwellings. That's the big deal. Got it? Cyrus Cylinder doesn't talk about the Jewish people explicitly. It's all the people. We'll talk about next week. When we talk about next week, we'll do the first couple lines of the Book of Ezra and discuss who is Koresh. And Koresh giving us the right to return, the Tanakh is going to put God's words into the mouth of Koresh. Koresh, in a historical document, in the Cyrus Cylinder, which is, that's the real thing, we see that he says that, what was his policy? The Babylonians had plundered the cities they took over. They took the gods out of their temples and all this sacred artifacts that they had. They brought them to their temples and to their king's abodes, and they were showing off how we conquered those other gods. And that's why the people hated the Babylonians. Cyrus, when he comes in, has a whole new approach, and he's going to allow all the ethnic people to return to the homelands with the images of their gods and build their temples. And at the command of Marduk, right, he settled all the inhabitants and pleasing their abodes, etc., and asked everyone to pray for his good. Basically, they're going to change the policy, so we'll talk about next week. And Koresh is not, he's called a servant of God, but he's not doing it. He never mentions our God in this thing. Why the Tanakh says he mentions our God, that we have to talk about next week. But if you have a chance, like sort of for homework, if you want to read the Cyrus Cylinder and the background to it, you can go to the British Museum website, you can go to Wikipedia. and just read the text itself. It's not that long. You can do the English. I don't want you, you don't have to learn cuneiform for next week's share. But next week we'll go into the thing. If anyone has questions, I'll stop the share now part. I'll take questions. But anyone who wants to leave can leave. You could have left beforehand anyhow. And again, for next week, what we're going to do is we're going to study the book of Ezra, the opening lines, and somehow we're going to get to Deuteronomy Isaiah and back to Chumash again. We'll see.
And thank you.
To Parshat Noah and Lech Lecha.
Thank you, Rabbi. Okay, while we wait, if anybody has any questions, just tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Rabbi Joseph Dweck, the senior rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese Shul in London, England, will start a three-part series on Sephardic, the effect on the Enlightenment on the Sephardic world. We're going to talk about Sephardic halakha tomorrow, pre-emancipation Sephardic halakha, and Sephardic and Ashkenazim developed, of course, in different ways and different approaches to halakha. As just Rabbi Liebdeck talking about different approaches to Zionism, we have different approaches to everything. We're very pluralistic people. And then we continue all week with our classes Monday night. Mark Shapiro, continuing his book series. Tuesday morning, Hebrew manuscripts, introduction to Hebrew manuscripts, Yoel Finkelman, Tuesday, 12:15, right followed by Benny Gesundheit right on Tehillim. Wednesday morning, Marty Lakshin on biblical commentaries they didn't teach you in Yeshiva, Shadal Mendelssohn and Rav David Zvi Hoffman. Wednesday night, we begin our series on the Haftorah of the week, Dr. Rabbi Moshe Sokolow. And Thursday morning, Shuli Miskin on archaeology, a four-part series in archaeology in the land of Israel, and then our Parsha Shir at night. So that's for the rest of the week. Keep you busy at Torah Motion E-Team channel, and pleasure to see everybody. Be well, and we look forward to any comments and suggestions and critique. We always like to hear what you have to say. So what, we're always looking to improve, to do more and better. So we